story of 1 Samuel is rapidly reaching its climax. That's the moment when Saul, the first king of Israel, will commit suicide on a battlefield. And the way will be made clear for David's, for God's chosen king, David, to take the throne. That account of the fall of King Saul is in chapter 31. Just before that, however, we have the chapter that we read earlier. And it's all about one last crisis that God put David through before David could become king. It was one final test for David to show that he was worthy to rise into that position as the king of God's people, the king of Israel. Let me firstly try to set the scene for you. Saul is still at this moment the king of Israel. He's a jealous man and a frightened man. He hates David, but he's given up his pursuit of him. And the reason for that is that David has gone to live amongst the Philistines, amongst Israel's great enemies. He's been based in Philistine territory for over a year. And during that year, he's managed to convince the Philistines that his days as Israel's great fighting hero are over. Achish, the king of the Philistine city of Gath, is completely won over. He's sure of David's now turned his back on Israel. He's sure that David's reliable, and he's sure that David's been rejected by his own people. To maintain that reputation, David's had to live a very secret life, a double life. He's had to deceive the Philistines. To survive, he's had to shelter his true motives from Achish and from the army of the Philistines, because in actual fact David hasn't renounced Israel at all. But he's just hiding out there. He doesn't know what he's going to do next. He's biding his time. He's waiting to see what will come. Now in chapter 30, David, with his private army, 600 men, are coming back to their home city of Ziklag. That's the city that the Philistine king, Achish, has given to them. It's the place where David and his men have made their base. And they've got all their families there and their possessions. You know that previously they've been on the march, on the run in fact, through the desert, through the wilderness. But now they actually have a home base. And that's where they've gathered their families, their possessions, everything. David has been sent back to Ziklag. He had been on the move with the main Philistine army. They had been a support legion going up with the Philistines. The Philistines themselves have marched out for battle with Israel. But the generals of that army, despite all that Achish says, don't quite trust David, don't trust these Jewish warriors. And so they've insisted that he should go home again. They've sent him back to this town. And that's what we find him doing at the start of chapter 30. David and his men reach Ziklag on the third day. They've come back. They've been sent home. Now it's on his return to that town that David is plunged into this terrible crisis. And it could have been one of absolute disaster. The homecoming to Ziklag could have seen the end of David's journey to the kingship. In fact, it could have been the moment of David's death. Not at the hands of Saul, but at the hands of his own men. It was a real time of testing for David. Let me talk about the crisis that's found in this chapter by making 6 points, two groups of 3 points each. First of all, I want to look at three troubles that David faced. And then I want to look at three reactions that David gave to his troubles. Three troubles, and then three reactions. First of all, what are the three troubles? The first one is that this crisis for David was totally unexpected. We aren't told in the story that David received a message to come home at once. In fact, we aren't given any indication that he was expecting trouble. In fact, we're given rather the opposite. David had been ready to lead his men off to war. He'd been marching out. He only came home because of the Philistine generals sending him home. David would hardly have taken that attitude. He'd hardly have been marching out on campaign if he thought Ziklag was in trouble. This raid came out of the blue. Facing the unexpected can really test us. Life is generally much easier when we know what's coming next, isn't it? When we're moving along in a routine, and the matters that we have to deal with are routine. Even if we're very busy people, even if we have a full life, it's easier to press on when the things we're doing are things that we know we're supposed to be doing. It's just part of the job, it's just part of family life, it's just part of our responsibilities, whatever they are. What can really throw us out are the unexpected events that grab hold of us, that eat up our time and our energy, that generate stress, that strain our emotions. It's those situations that can make us struggle. But those times, we have to see, I think, that those times are vital to our spiritual lives. The peaceful rolling on of life is a great delight, but it can make us spiritual slouches. People who become mediocre or complacent, maybe not in our personalities, maybe not in the things we do, but in our walk with God. An outward contented face can be hiding an inner life that's wandered from God, a soul that no longer feels dependent upon its God, a soul that's become self-satisfied or self-reliant or self-seeking, or just which has quietly sort of gone into a sleep. The unexpected event opens up the inner life. As we react to the big or small crisis, it exposes what we're like deep down. And it causes us to ask questions of ourselves. As we're reacting to this thing that's broken upon us, we see what we're like. We see maybe that we're prone to anger, or we see that very easily we sink into depression, or we see that we lack faith, we lack hope. Sometimes some of us, when we're confronted with something like that, we don't want to see what we are. Instead, what we do is we grab on to some activity, or maybe even some sin, to divert attention. In the midst of the crisis, we just want something else to do, because we don't like what it's showing us, what it's saying to us. When the unexpected event breaks upon you, you should see that God is testing you. He's exposing what you're really like. He's giving you a chance for a moment to see what you're like on the inside. God was doing that to David when he brought that trouble on him, when this unexpected event blew up in his face. But before we think about David's reaction, let's see a second trouble he faced. The second trouble is that there were a number of things about this crisis that David simply didn't know. He didn't know who had made the raid. We know, we were told it's the Amalekites, but he didn't know that. At first, all they can see is a burned out town where everything they loved once had been. All their possessions have gone. And more importantly, all their families have vanished. It isn't until verse 11, when they're out hunting for the raiding party, and they meet an ill and malnourished Egyptian slave. It's only then they discover the truth. After feeding him, reviving him, it's David's first question. To whom do you belong, and where do you come from? David's in this trouble, but he doesn't know who's causing it. He can't make plans, he doesn't know how to react. He doesn't know who the enemy is. And then, of course, David doesn't know what's happened to their families. He can guess. He can assume, well, they've been kidnapped. Because there's no evidence of them being killed. There's no burned bones lying on the ground. But he can't be sure. Because he doesn't know. He doesn't know who the enemy is. He doesn't know where the enemy is to be found. He doesn't know what the enemy is likely to have done. Facing situations where we're dealing with the unknown can really test us too. You see, dealing with unknown situations, going into places where we're not sure, tests our trust in God. God is the one who knows all things. He knows the past, he knows the present, he knows the future. And those of us who are Christians are willing to say that. It's part of what we believe. We believe in the God who is all-knowing. But believing it as a statement, and believing it when we are actually having to face an uncertain future, are two different things, aren't they? Whilst I'm confident about what's happening and what's coming, then I can stand up and I can sing that hymn. I can sing, "I know who holds the future, and he'll guide me with his hand." It's great singing that when we know the future. It's much harder when we don't know what's coming next, isn't it? To believe that that is true of God. You think, let's say an example, a Christian man who loses his job. And at first he's looking to God to provide a new one. But the unemployment goes on week after week, interview after interview, and he becomes disheartened. Will he find work again? What will the job be when he gets one? Will he have enough money in the meantime to meet the bills? Is he going to lose his house? The uncertainty and the worry can be crippling for that man, not knowing where the crisis is leading to. Take another example, a Christian girl. Let's say she's in her last term at university, and then she hears that her mother has been diagnosed with cancer. She has to go into her final exams, uncertain about the future, no longer even sure how well she will do, because since she's heard that news, there's been so much on her mind that all the revision has gone to pot. Coming into situations where the unknown is pressing in on us, where we find ourselves uncertain about this or about that, is very hard. It's a test. It's a test to see whether we truly do trust in the God who knows all things. God was testing David in that way as he stood with his men and looked at the burning remains of that town. But again, before we think about David's reaction then, let's think about a third trouble he faced. The third trouble that David faced was this. He had to face unrest and unhappiness amongst his supporters. In other words, he had to face the disruption of the relationships that had been his greatest help, the men who served him. David's men have faced so much with him. They've followed him all over the place. They've wandered through the desert. They've hidden in caves. They've even lived amongst the enemy with him. They've supported him through all sorts of situations and troubles. But now for them, this is a step too far. The loss of their families is an agonizing disaster. And they're prepared to blame David. They're going to stone him to death in their anger. Their loyalty to this king has been, or this warrior at the moment, has been pushed beyond its limits as far as they're concerned. Their reaction is irrational. David didn't know this was going to happen. He didn't know they were going to arrive back in Ziklag to find this. If he had, he'd have taken a different course of action, wouldn't he, to have protected their loved ones. But these people are upset, they're angry, they're emotionally perturbed. They want somebody to blame. And David, as their leader, is the obvious candidate. Take it out on him, they say. The disruption of a relationship, the tearing apart of a friendship, can really test us. The friends that God gives to us are very important. They help us, they talk to us, they counsel us. If they're Christians, they pray for and with us. And those relationships can be very strong. They can have deep roots that go right down into our hearts. So disrupting those relationships can be agony. When some quarrel comes up which casts a shadow over a friendship, then it can spoil the other parts of life too. The shadow casts wide, doesn't it? When events pull friends apart, you get somebody moving house, you get somebody getting married, and it leaves us feeling lonely and left out, as though God has been cutting chunks out of our lives. When a misunderstanding leaves friends unsure of each other, why did she say that to me? It makes us uneasy. It gives us the sense that maybe we don't really understand our friend after all. Disrupted relationships can happen in so many different ways, and their pain can be great. But that is a test that God puts us through at times. He put David through that. These were his men. They had suffered together. They had fought together. And now David actually hears them talking about doing him in. What a test to face. But God was checking him to see if David regarded his Lord as the greatest of all friends. Think of another hymn. One there is above all others. Well deserves the name of friend. Great to sing, isn't it? Harder to believe. Still harder to feel and live by. The Lord's my shepherd and I'll not want, wrote David. Does he believe that when his friends are talking of killing him? Does he believe that his God is still close to him, caring for him, loving him? Three parts to David's troubles. He faced the unexpected. He faced the unknown, the uncertain. And he faced the disruption of close relationships. And through these troubles, God was testing David. David was a believer. He was a man who loved God, who followed God, who served God. He was a believer. And the all-powerful, all-knowing God knew that. God knew David through and through. He could see down, right down into the most private recesses of his soul. But God still put him to the test. Because it would show to others, and it would show to David himself, the truth about himself. These hard circumstances would both prepare David, they would be the final step in making him ready to be king. And they would show him that he was worthy to be king. Those of us who are Christians need to remember that when we pass through hard circumstances. God is at work in those situations. He's seeing what we are. He's showing us what we are. And he's leading us towards what we should be. Now let's see that in David. What are David's three reactions to these troubles? Let's take them in reverse order. So we'll begin with the last one I mentioned. The last thing I said just a moment ago was this. That David faced the disruption of relationships. Potentially the fatal breaking up of his army. Certainly fatal to him. How did he react? We're told in verse 6. David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. But David found strength in the Lord his God. If this had been another episode in the life of David, we might have heard about Jonathan turning up, mightn't we? Saul's son, coming out to encourage David, coming out to help him. Jonathan has been David's strengthener, his best friend. He's helped David at various points to cope with his trials. But Jonathan's about to die. David can no longer depend upon Jonathan to see him through. And he doesn't. Verse 6 tells us that David, by himself, looks to God for strength to come through. David knows that God is the great friend that he needs at this moment. The test drove David to God. It showed him that he needed God, but the result of that then was that he depended more upon his God. Does it work that way for you? People let you down. Sometimes they let you down by their sins. They do things that make you feel sad. They treat you or they treat others in bad ways. Their sins bring trouble down upon them, and it has an effect on you. Sometimes people just let you down in their friendship with you. You fall out with them over some decision within the church, or you disagree with them over some aspect of Christian living. You have a quarrel with them about something that's happened on a personal level, or even in a public setting. They don't keep a promise that they've made to you, or they're not always what you'd hope they would be for you. People let you down. But does it drive you closer to God or not? It should do. God is testing you to see what you will do when you find that you can't depend upon other people. Other people can't maintain your Christian life for you. They can't keep you interested in spiritual things. They can't make you holy. They can be used by God to help with all those things. Jonathan did help David to find strength in his Lord. Jonathan did play a valuable role in David's life, but not by being a God substitute. And the proof of that was when David had to cope without Jonathan being there. Now, there's nothing magic about this. David found the strength here because he'd already been seeking it at other times. The relationship with God has to be built today, now, not tomorrow when the test comes. If you have an exam to sit in a month's time, then you need to be studying and learning the subject now. Opening up the textbooks the morning before the exam is a technique that some of us have tried, and it doesn't work. You have to prepare before the test comes, not just hope for the best when it comes. It's something we must do in our spiritual lives. We must seek to know God and to walk with God now, today. So today's a peaceful day. Today's an ordinary day. There's no crisis. Everything's great. That's fine. Then use the opportunity to walk with your God, so that when that day does come, and particularly when that friendship is suddenly taken away from you, however it's taken, because every friendship in the end will be taken away through death, if through nothing else, then it's to God that you immediately turn in distress. It's in God you find your most loyal friend. It's in God you suddenly realise you were looking to, even through that other close human friend. Thank God that he does help us to do that. He does prepare us for the future, just as he prepared David. David was given Jonathan for those years in the desert, for those hard years of wilderness wanderings. He wasn't left with no one who could understand him, no one who loved him. Only when David was ready was Jonathan removed. David came into his kingdom at the right time under the hand of God. The trials that you face, the tests, will come at the right time. God's not uncaring. He knows when we are ready to face the painful tests that we must face. That's his promise to Christians. He doesn't push us cruelly into situations when we're not ready, when there's no hope of us surviving. He describes himself as our shepherd. He guides his flock. He brings them into the places, the hard places or the easier places, at the right time. He is the one who guides us through the days of our lives. This is only for believers, though. God is a friend and the shepherd of those who know him, who have repented of their sins, who have put their trust in the Son of God, Jesus Christ. If you don't have him, then you don't have that promise. You'll face crises. Your friends will be taken from you through one thing or another, and there'll be no ultimate friend to go to. Don't stay away from God now. If he's given you peacefulness today, and friends, and no crisis, don't use it as an excuse to ignore him now. Tomorrow may be different. Today is the day that you must sort out your relationship with God. David had. He had that love for God, and it saw him through this time of disturbed, of disrupted friendships. However, we can then ask how all this was worked out. What did it mean for David? Well, to see that, let's go on to the second trouble that David faced. What was his reaction to the unknown, to being in uncertain times? David's reaction was to go to God and ask for wisdom, ask for guidance. In verse 7, David turns to Abiathar, who's the priest, the son of Ahimelech, and he tells him to bring the ephod. This is the priestly object that could be used in those days to inquire of God, to ask God questions. And David asked God this question: shall I pursue this raiding party? David doesn't know at all what to do next. He feels bewildered. This is the great warrior. This is the one who can lead his men through the desert. But he doesn't know what to do. And he receives an answer from God: pursue them. You will certainly overtake and succeed in the rescue. What David hears from God is a sure reply and a great promise. God says, I will bring a good conclusion to this time of distress. And David responds believingly to that promise. He sets out with his 600 men, and he catches up with the raiding party, and he attacks them. He didn't know who these men were, or where they were, or how many they were. Everything was unknown to him, but he knows what God has said, and he believes that in obeying it, he gains what God has promised. A Christian lives that way, believing the promises of God, trusting the promises of God. Jesus taught his people very clearly to build their lives on what God has said and what God has promised. You hear it clearly in his dispute when Jesus himself is just reacting, in his dispute with the devil in the desert. He quotes to the devil, people do not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. What God has said, says Jesus, is more important even than the very stuff that keeps our physical bodies alive. God's words are so full of life that they are to be given the priority over all things, says Jesus. That is the Christian's goal, to have God's words and God's promises play that part in our lives. You hear it in Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. A life, says Jesus for the Christian, is a life built on what God has promised. Not on what we can see, not on what we can hear or touch and taste now, but on what God has promised. It's hard, isn't it? God isn't an absent parent on a guilt trip. He isn't like the man who is never there for his kids, but who spends lots of money at Toys R Us trying to make up for it, to salve his conscience with presents that are supposed to show his love. We don't judge God's love for us by the things, the objects, the trinkets that he gives to us now. God's love is shown by what he has told us that he's done for us, and by what he has promised he will do for us. We who are Christians are supposed to be building our lives on what God has said and what God has promised. Would you react like David? Is it to God you go when things become unclear, uncertain, unsure? Is your life being built upon what God has said and what God has promised? God may one day test you on that. Maybe he'll take something away from you to see how you react, as he did with David. Are you ready? Have you prepared yourself now by centering your life upon that relationship with God, listening to God now, trusting what God has promised now? That is the one thing that no one can take from you. But then we might ask what the result of all this listening and trust was for David. How do we see it worked out? And that brings us full circle back to the first trouble that I said David faced. I said at the start that one of the tests which David had to cope with was dealing with the unexpected. The crisis broke upon him when he didn't expect it to. One moment he thought he was going to march out to war, the next moment he'd been sent home. But what he didn't expect to find was his city ransacked and burned, his family and his belongings gone. How did he react to this unplanned for disaster? What flowed from his heart, this heart that was listening to God, believing God? What came from David was thoughtful obedience. He did what God told him, and he did it carefully, and he did it thoughtfully. When David and his men eventually caught up with the criminals who had raided their town, who did they find them to be? They found them to be the Amalekites. Now, you may remember that the Amalekites appear earlier in the story of 1 Samuel. They're the tribe that Saul was supposed to wipe out in punishment for their crimes. And Saul didn't. Saul failed. And here they are again, troubling David, turning up in the story once more. Saul failed, not because of inadequate resources, not because his army was too small, but because he wouldn't fully obey God. God had told him what to do, but Saul was not willing to give that total obedience. Saul didn't have a heart to listen to God and do just what God said. Well, David too is now being tested by God using the Amalekites. I wonder if David thought about that as he heard the Egyptian slave say, "I am the slave of an Amalekite." Did he sense a key moment, the very tribe who were the occasion for the downfall and rejection of Saul as king of Israel? David and his men launched their attack on this drunken, reveling group. And they defeat them, they fight them through the day, and they kill almost all of them, just 400 escape. As God promised, the rescue mission was completely successful. They returned from battle rejoicing in it, because they've not just got their families back and their possessions back, but they've gained a lot too. They've plundered the Amalekites. But what we see then is that David's obedience to what God told him to do is thoughtful obedience. Having won the promised victory, now he thinks carefully what's to follow. He thinks carefully about the plunder he's gained. If you remember the story, Saul actually fell into trouble over the matter of plunder. He'd been told to take nothing home when he defeated the Amalekites. But what happened was that he and his men didn't feel like doing that. They decided they'd help themselves to the best of the livestock and take them back with them. And then when they got there and Samuel told them off, they excused themselves because they were bringing sacrifices to God. So it was all right anyway. Now David wasn't told anything by God about taking things from the Amalekites. David has done exactly what God told him to do. Pursue the enemy, defeat them. So surely he was now free to benefit any way he wanted. He could indulge himself. He could take all this for himself. And the men assume that. In verse 20 they say, "This is David's plunder." But for David, obedience to God is more than just, "Right, I've done exactly what God says, that's enough." It's thoughtful. David has a heart for God. He makes sure his men benefit from all that's been gained. And he makes sure that all the men benefit. Not just the 400 who actually went with him into the fight, but the 200 who were too exhausted to carry on. He says, everyone will be treated equally. You've inevitably got the ones who have been involved in the fight going on about the other people, saying they don't deserve anything of it, they don't bother doing anything, they just sit here by the ravine. But David says, no, this will be shared equally across all my men. And more than that, he then sends out gifts to the people who have helped him in the past, to the people in Judah at one town and another and another. There's no selfishness operating here. David just isn't out for self-aggrandizement. He isn't just out to gain things for himself. David is thoughtful. He wants to do what's right. He wants to act in the best way. He gives thoughtful obedience to God. Because he's a man with a heart for God, a man who listens to God, a man who knows God's promises. As Christians, we must be like David. Our great concern should be to build up our relationship with God. We've been called to know and love God as our Father. And we must be working in that relationship, that it would grow in love. But how do we do it? We do it by concentrating, as I've said, upon what God has said and what God has promised, and then giving obedience to them that's thoughtful, that's open, that's wide, that wants to do as much as God has said, to gain as much as possible of what God has promised. As we learn about all that God has said to us, then that will strengthen our love for our Father in heaven, because we'll know him better. And as we learn about what God has promised, it will extend our love for God, because we'll be looking forward to all that he's planned for us. And it's then in that context that we give this thoughtful obedience. Not just a spirit which says, God tells me to do this, so I'd better do it. But a spirit which is looking, longing to live in every way as God desires. A spirit, in other words, which isn't always asking, what must I do? But instead which is asking, what can I do for my God? What attitude do you have when it comes to living for God? Are you a what must I do Christian? Do you hear about what God has said in his book and react with a sigh and a silent wish that God had never said that? Do you try to limit the consequences of things that God has said, to try and minimise the impact, to try and just tone it down to the bare essentials? Well, God's told me to do this, so okay, I'll do it. I don't need to do that bit, do I? Or are you a what can I do Christian? Do you hear about what God has said in his book and then look for ways to live out that command? Do you want to take what God has said, really understand it, really understand why he said it, and then live a life that meets that purpose that God had in those words, a life that pleases God? That should be our goal as believers. We can easily slip into the what must I do frame of mind, keep down the list of duties, find the excuses for not doing this or that in our personal Christian walk or whatever. We must pray for and seek the "what can I do" attitude. An attitude which delights to give thoughtful obedience to the commands and the words of God, because it clings to the promises of God, because it knows the love of God and love for God. Surely that must be the way to live. If we as believers really are, as the Bible says, those who love God with all our hearts, all our souls, all our minds, and all our strength. Surely that must be what we want.